In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with novelist Kathleen Camber, and we will be talking about her most recent and second novel. It's titled In Sunlight in a Beautiful Garden. The book is published by Farrar Straus Giroux and has been getting some good notices. It is a book that uses as its backdrop one of the more legendary natural disasters in American history, and that is the Johnstown Flood. This occurred on Memorial Day, 1889, when the South Fork Dam burst and more than 2,000 people were killed. Above the dam was a hunting and fishing club where some of the day's wealthiest people spent some of their summer, and below was the town of Johnstown, where people there just live their daily lives. It's a story that gives an opportunity to say some things about how difficult it is to reach across lines of class. And also, it says a lot about the role that disaster plays in people's lives. Kathleen Camber will be talking with us this morning, and of course, as we do that, anyone who's listening is welcome to call. In addition to being the author of the book In Sunlight in a Beautiful Garden, she's written another novel, The Book of Mercy, that was published in 1996. That was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Prize. She is now, or did at one time, from 1997 till the end of last year, she directed the creative writing program at the University of Houston and makes her home in Houston, Texas. She's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we do, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Camber, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, I'm very happy to talk with you.
The very first line of the book, of the prologue, is to understand the geography was to understand the place. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what the geography of this this area. What's the place, the area around Johnstown like?
Johnstown is about an hour and a half from Pittsburgh, and it's in the Allegheny Mountains. And it sits at the bottom of a level floodplain in a very deep valley. So it is surrounded to this day by very steep hills on all sides. Having read about this, the geographic location, I was really very stunned when I went to visit to understand how much it sits kind of in the bottom. It's cupped by these mountains. And, of course, when the flood did finally come to Johnstown, people had a bit of warning because of the sound. There was a terrible sound as this 70-foot wall of water descended upon the city. And actually being in Johnstown and imagining people trying to get up these extraordinary steep hills was a very moving experience for me. The South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club lay at a level of 240 feet above Johnstown, about 15 miles away. And there was a narrow valley coming from the place of the club and the dam. And the water, as it burst out of the dam, concentrated itself in this narrow valley and gained force and gained momentum and gained and accumulated in itself an enormous amount of rubble. It was also the case that the Pennsylvania Railroad had a line, a direct line, to Johnstown from Pittsburgh, so that the wealthy members of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club could go directly to the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club and really bypass Johnstown, and in that way keep the notion of life in the valley out of the range of their consciousness. I think in many cases, even though there was a kind of peripheral knowledge, the members of the club didn't ever really imagine or see what life in Johnstown was like. Johnstown was not simply an impoverished place. It had a very lively steel mill. It had a lot of industry. There was a great sense of hope in Johnstown. People were working. It was Johnstown itself and several boroughs and a number of small towns in the valley leading up towards the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. So it was a place of extraordinary liveliness and hope, and the man who ran the steel mill there, Daniel J. Morrell, was a very forward-thinking Quaker. Conditions there were much more humane than one thought of in relation to the conditions in steel mills at that particular time in history.
Mm-hmm.
So the distance between the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club and Johnstown, the fact that the train travel made it possible to almost imagine that Johnstown didn't exist, all those kinds of things seem to me to produce a kind of geographical equation that contributed to what happened.
Yeah. So you had this large body of water elevated, this trough, natural sort of trough that it could run in, and this earthen dam that held it back.
Yes.
Apparently, as you tell the story in the book, sometime before the club was established, there had been this idea in Pennsylvania of building a system of canals that would connect Pittsburgh and Johnstown. And that's how this idea of damming, putting the dam there so that you could get the water for the canals came about. That plan never went anywhere, but then they ended up with this lake, and apparently then there were some wealthy folks who were looking for a place to establish a kind of a resort club. And someone said, well, here we got this lake, why not here?
Well, the interesting thing was that the Pennsylvania Railroad actually did build the Portage Railroad, so that there were a system of canals in Johnstown. And a Portage Railroad, where railroad cars were taken by rope and hauled over the mountains. This was a way to try to get transportation and products from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia and from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. And Charles Dickens rode on the Portage Railroad and visited Johnstown. So it actually was in working order and used, as usually impractical as it sounds. I mean, if you can imagine canals getting these large, flat boats, canal boats, with train cars on them and getting them to a certain point and then having them hauled with ropes over a mountain and down the other side to get access again to waterways to get to Philadelphia. It's an incredibly complicated ordeal, but they did actually build it, and it was actually in existence for some time, and Charles Dickens did write about it and rode on it when he came to America, and there is actually a quote in the book of what he had to say about that. But within months of the Portage Railroad being built and successful, the Pennsylvania Railroad had built an all-rail line across the mountains, and so the Portage Railroad became obsolete, and the dam that had been built by the Pennsylvania Railroad to make the lake that made the water possible for the canals became obsolete, and so the Pennsylvania Railroad allowed the earth dam to fall into disrepair. Earth dams, as it turns out, are extremely sound if they're built properly. And in my research, I learned the things that were required to have an earth dam remain sound. The top of the dam could never be breached. So if the level of the water in the lake that was held by the dam needed to be many feet below the top of the dam. There needed to be discharge pipes built in the base of the dam with a system of levers that could open them and release the water into the valley in a controlled way if the water in the lake rose too much. and there was a spillway on, there should be a spillway on one side of a dam so that the water can spill over the spillway should water rise to dangerously high levels in the lake. When the Pennsylvania Railroad allowed the dam to fall into disrepair, these safety precautions began to be breached. And then when the members of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club bought the property with the idea of having a lake and a clubhouse and stables and sailboats and so forth, they bought it from a man who had removed the discharge pipes for the cost of the scrap metal. When the club members bought the dam, they lowered the surface of the dam in order to widen it so a road could be built across so that the carriages could, with the luggage of the summer people, could go across the top. And they stocked the lake with very expensive black bass for the fishing pleasure of the members of the club. And in order to keep those fish in the lake and not fall over the spillway and go down into the valley where the valley residents could fish for them, they built a very elaborate set of fish screens that then could clog with debris and really interfere with the overflow over the spillway. So those kinds of things, I mean, if they had bought the property in the lake and rebuilt the dam properly and then seen to what were known then as the engineering principles to keep an earth dam safely constructed, then there may not have been any kind of tragedy. But somehow those things were ignored.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with novelist Kathleen Camber. She has written two, her first, The Book of Mercy, published in 1996, and her newest, it's titled In Sunlight, In a Beautiful Garden. And it does indeed involve the Johnstown flood of 1889, the event that here we've been talking about. And questions also welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You know, one review that I read of the book made the observation that one of the things that keeps people turning pages and when they're reading a novel is that they want to know what happens. And in this particular story, at least as far as the main event goes, from the beginning, the reader knows what's going to happen. Was that for you as a writer a particular challenge to try and maintain the interest of readers when they knew perfectly well the dam was going to break and there was going to be a big flood and a couple thousand people were going to be killed and the town was really going to be devastated?
You know, it's interesting. I've had a number of letters from readers who began the book thinking, well, what about that? And have said that they found the book to be enormously suspenseful and anxiety-producing because what is not known as the reader's reading is which of these characters are going to survive this flood and which are not, and what things were leading up to the flood, what human stories were transpiring that allowed the reader to feel highly invested in all of the characters, one hopes, all of the characters in such a way that the readers then would care deeply about, all right, yes, the flood was coming, but what would be the human cost in terms of the people that the readers come to know during the course of reading the book? Obviously, that's something that I hoped would happen, and I did realize the dangers of this when I began. An early draft of the book, I actually began with a description of the flood. And then, of course, I had to make decisions about how much of the minute-to-minute drama of the flood was going to be central to the book, and I realized that I wanted to write, I didn't want to write a quote-unquote disaster novel. I really wanted to look at and live the lives of all of these people, the people who were in Johnstown and beginning to find some happiness and some prosperity, and the men, Andrew Mellon Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, other people who, the men who were responsible for the building of the club and the maintenance of the dam, what they were like, what it was about that point in their careers. And Frick and Mellon were relatively young. Carnegie at that point was, a good 15 to 20 years older than the two of them. But I really wanted to focus on that time. The club was in existence for 9 years, and I made a very conscious decision to focus on the lives of these people and the kinds of things that contributed to who they were and what attention they were unable to pay to something that ought to have been very frightening to everyone involved, so that one cared even more deeply about the flood when it did come, because everyone knew the characters as well as I hope they came to know them during the course of the book.
I don't know if this is too pedestrian an observation, but it would certainly seem that this is a rather potent metaphor for everything that in life you try to hold back, and eventually what happens is the dam breaks. You know, and there's a, you know, that we go about repressing an awful lot of stuff. There are things that we really should deal with that we don't, and eventually it just becomes too much.
You know, it is one of the great lessons of history. I mean, you could also say, which I think you're saying is also one of the great lessons of psychology, but you know, it is so easy when people become preoccupied with whatever their preoccupations come in the business world, for example, to not pay attention to the simple things that need to be attended to in relation to making industry safe, caring deeply for the men and women whose responsibility is yours if you're an employer. So I think at an historical level, it's important too. And when we have the great discrepancies between, which we still do in this country and in many countries, between very well-paid employers and captains of industry, their less well-paid workers, I think there is really a valuable lesson to be learned from what can happen if you don't pay the simplest kind of attention. I mean, $17,000 went into the repair of this dam. These were, I mean, Mellon, Frick, Carnegie were only three of many wealthy members of this club. Clearly, $17,000 for any one of them was nothing. I mean, it wasn't a question of this was simply too complicated a problem to solve. They couldn't possibly do it. It was a question of not caring enough to pay the kind of attention to tend to a problem that was easily solved. You know, I did not want to write a didactic novel. Let me beat you over the head with this kind of story. And I began to write the novel because I was just so curious about the time and the people and how this kind of thing happens in the world. But I did realize as I was writing it that there were, for me, and so I assumed for readers, many lessons, both the lesson of history and, as you say, the psychological lesson. We can ignore and ignore and ignore all kinds of things, but those kinds of things too often catch up with us sooner or later in any case. And there's a lot to be said for having a nagging sense that there's a problem and turning your attention to that problem and trying to do something about it before something horrible happens.
Mm. Well, you know, one character that was, some of the names in the book, like Carnegie and Mellon, were familiar to me. At least I had heard of them. I don't know how much I could have told you about them.
Uh-huh.
But one name that was really not familiar was Henry Clay Frick, and perhaps it should have been, at least in the sense that he was a very important art collector and left behind him what I think some people think was one of the greatest private art collections ever put Absolutely. Together. He was a partner of Carnegie, and
yes.
in fact, he was the guy that made Carnegie Brothers the biggest steelmaker in the world, and then went on to play a very important role in the formation of United States Steel.
Yes.
So he was an important guy, and I guess I'm sort of surprised that really that his name didn't much register with me.
Well, the problem is that the Frick family has never wanted a biography to be written about him. It is my understanding that that lawsuits were filed for a long time against people who did attempt to write biographies. The family asked a family friend to write a biography not long after Henry Clay Frick died, and that biography is very laudatory. It really portrays a man who is a saint. Certainly, we're all very complicated people, and none of us are saints, and certainly Henry Clay Frick was not a saint. But the wealth of the Fricks, and also actually the Mellons, have made it possible for them to not allow very fine biographies to be written about these men. And I was amazed at how little I could find about Andrew Mellon, for example. I was really stunned by that. Now, there are many biographies of Carnegie. He was very affable. He was always writing papers about labor, papers about all kinds of things being published. But Frick was very private during his lifetime, and the family wanted the picture painted of a man who had done nothing wrong, who had the terrible burden of these workers to contend with, and who was happy and prosperous and happy in his art collecting. There is an interesting story that it could be apocryphal, but is certainly repeated often enough. Frick and Carnegie had a terrible falling out over money. Frick wanted out of the Carnegie Brothers enterprises, and everyone who worked for Carnegie had signed what was called an ironclad agreement that made it very difficult for people to leave with the money that was rightfully theirs. And so there were lawsuits, and there was great animosity between them. And Frick actually kind of leaped over his desk at one point and attacked Carnegie. And towards the end of Carnegie's life, Carnegie, although again much older, and Frick died in the same year, and Carnegie sent an emissary to Frick saying, "It's been all these years, don't you think? I mean, we had a relationship once. Don't you think that we should bury the hatchet," or whatever term they used at that time, and put this behind us? And Frick sent the emissary back to Carnegie with the message, "Tell Mr. Carnegie I'll see him in hell where we're both going." This is hardly the message of a man who felt absolutely at peace with everything that he had done. Of course, you know, Frick became the great villain in the Homestead Strike, which is a very important part of labor history in this country. 1892, just a few years after the Johnstown flood, where the strike in Homestead was broken by Pinkerton guards, and shots were fired, and it was really one of the very blackest moments, and is still thought of that way in American labor history. And it was really Frick. Carnegie was in Scotland and wanted Frick to do whatever he had to do to break that strike, and he did in the most ruthless way. So he obviously, as we all are, was a very complicated man. He left as a gift to this country a wonderful art collection. His philanthropy is well known. He was also extremely ruthless and extremely greedy. His goal from the time he was a very, very young man was to become wealthy, and whatever he needed to do that, he was willing to do. But I was amazed at the dearth of information about both Mellon and Frick.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was that about how you treated these historical characters. I'm sure that you did research and found out about them what you could.
Yes.
But I guess I also was wondering whether you felt how constrained you felt by facts, or whether you indeed felt that they were as much your characters as the characters that you created.
Well, I felt very constrained by facts, but not constrained in a bad way. And then there were things that, I mean, for example, everything about the courtship of Carnegie and Louise Whitfield is based, there's lots of information about that. And his, you know, letters to her, how he met her, the opposition of his mother to that marriage, all of that is historically documented. And I simply brought it, I hope, I brought it to life as I knew about it. In terms of taking fictional liberties, for example, the only thing I was able to find out about Mellon and his courtship and his fiance, he fell in love as a young woman with someone about whom he apparently felt very impassioned. She developed tuberculosis, died in the long and unhappy way that people with tuberculosis died in those days. There's in the books that I read, there's no mention of her name. This is mentioned in passing. It took him many, many years to recover from this and marry again, and that marriage was an enormous disaster, which certainly leads, I mean, reading between the lines of all of this indicates that this was the great passion of his life and that he never truly recovered from the loss of it. So I felt able to take some fictional liberties and imagine what that courtship might have been like, given all I'd read about courtships at that time, and what the progress of tuberculosis was like during that time, and what love might have meant to Mellon at that point in his life, because he was an extremely shy, withdrawn young man, very much under the thumb of a very powerful father, and how freeing and moving it must have been to him to discover this other capacity in himself. So I felt able to take that kind of liberty based on what I know to be facts, that this experience actually happened to him. So that made it challenging but also very interesting. So I was very scrupulous. I did an enormous amount of research for this book and was scrupulous about adhering to what I knew to be factual, and also then able to imagine a bit about what it, when there was not enough detail, allow myself to imagine some of the detail that might have taken place around incidents. The same thing around the Dickens trip to Johnstown. He actually did go through Johnstown. He had left his children at home when he was on his trip to America. Did he disembark from a boat? And no, I don't know. I imagine he was a very affable traveler and very interested in people. So that small scene is imagined. The fact that he came through Johnstown and the Portage Railroad is not imagined. So those are the kinds of things that I did.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I guess I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Kathleen Camber is the author of the recent novel In Sunlight in a Beautiful Garden, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. It is her second. Her first was The Book of Mercy in 1996. Between 97 and the end of last year, she directed the creative writing program at the University of Houston and makes her home there in Houston, Texas. And if you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have the toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Something else about the book that really impresses me is the obvious care that you've taken to learn about the lives and activities of the people that you write about. And as you mentioned right at the very beginning, Johnstown was a very important steel making center. And two of your characters, one a man named Frank Fallon, works in the steel mill, and then his son also spent some time working in the mill. And I was most impressed by your description of the steel making process. Not only what was it just, I thought, really beautiful, but it certainly seemed to have an authentic ring to it. Now, I wouldn't know, but I was just very, very struck by that.
I tend to be a great over-researcher. I feel as if I have to know everything that there is to know in order to create the world that I'm trying to create. And I read many, many books about the making of steel, the very earliest Bessemer plants. So I just read and read and read and read until it seemed central to my thinking. Until, I mean, I joked with a friend when I was doing the research that I felt as if I could now build an earth dam. If anyone needed one built, I would be the person to call. I began to feel the same way about the making of steel. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and the mythology of steel making, of the heat and the difficulty, and also the magical beauty of it at the same time, was always very striking to me, and part of the mythology in the Pittsburgh that I grew up in, Pittsburgh of working people and Irish and German immigrants, who many of whom were steel workers, and I really wanted to describe that in its difficulties, but also in its extraordinary beauty, and the power and satisfaction that must have been had by men who understood what an extraordinary enterprise it was. Very dangerous, to be sure, but also making the metal that was changing the entire world. One of the things that touched me enormously as I was doing my research is that in Johnstown, the workers dressed in their Sunday clothes to go to the pay window on Saturday to pick up their paychecks out of a sense of pride in of respect for Mr. Morrell, who was the owner of the Cambria Iron Works, and also out of a sign of respect for themselves and the work that they were doing. And I found that to be extremely moving, and it said a lot to me about that work and the meaning of that work to the people who were doing it. So I read a great deal about that history and exactly what happens in an effort to make it both awe-inspiring and beautiful at the same time. Thank you for thinking it was beautiful. Again, it was a struggle to make it all that I thought it should be.
Well, I think you were very successful, and I was just last night reading, and one passage just struck me, and I just said, wow, this is really good. And it does indeed, I think you get a feeling for the power and the danger of the molten steel, and how these people who are working with it are doing something that's almost unnatural. The idea that human beings would manipulate this stuff, this molten metal of thousands of degrees, the kinds of thing that, of course, if you touched it, that would be it. And certainly people died in the enterprise. But I think it's very, very powerful stuff, very good stuff.
And of course, there was none of the protective equipment at the time.
Right.
There is, I mentioned in the author's note at the beginning of the book, the many books that I read and the things that helped me. There's a remarkable documentary about the Johnstown flood that was done by Charles Guggenheim, and there are some old photographs in that, and actually very, very old film, probably not as old as 1889, but very old film of steel workers making steel, and they're standing, you know, they kind of are putting their hands up over their eyes like it's sun or something, you know, no goggles, nothing. It's amazing to think of the protections that were not available and the fact that everyone went to work every day and did this extraordinarily dangerous work with none of the protective gear that people have today for all kinds of work.
I just last week, as a matter of fact, had the opportunity to talk with Peter Carey.
Oh, yes.
About his new book, the book about Ned Kelly.
Oh, yes.
And I had a nice conversation with him, and I think I asked the question that I've asked a couple of other people who have written historical fiction, and I guess I made by making the observation that it's said, and it's I think it's certainly true, is that historical fiction is as much about the time that it's being written as it is about the time that it's set. And
yeah.
And having said that, I'm interested in hearing from you a little bit about how this book, In Sunlight in a Beautiful Garden, that's set in before the turn of the century, is in some way about now.
Well, I think it is very much about now. I think it is about, as I said, I think it can be thought of as a cautionary tale about how we treat other people, how possible it is for all humans to become blind to the plight of people that they regard as the other in some way. It struck me during the course of writing the book that people who were young people at the time of the Johnstown flood would have had fathers who fought in the Civil War and were at the right age, if they survived the flood, to have sons that fought in the First World War. And that war, of course, is so much about, it's about defending principles, it's about many other things, but it's also about a fierce inability to understand the point of view of others and have to go to the extreme to really fight it out in order to the fighters hope have their point of view prevail. And one of the things that struck me is that the men at the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club truly were blind in some way to the fact that there was a teeming life other than theirs in this valley. This is not to indict them or call them completely evil, but I think it occurred to me as I read about them and tried to imagine them and live their lives with them that it's a danger for all of us. I think it is a story of our time, too, because I think it's very easy to lose empathetic connection to people in the universe that are not like us. That can be in our own community, in our own country. It can be in the world, you know, that lack of empathetic understanding of what it might be like to be someone else. And again, I didn't begin the book so much with that in mind, but the more I researched and the more I wrote, the more I thought this is an ongoing problem with human nature, and it's a problem that deserves to be talked about and thought about and considered. And if this book brings a few people to be thinking about that again, I would be very happy to have that be the case.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit ago, I had asked you this question about dealing with historical characters, and you said you certainly felt constrained by the facts when facts were available, and then you did what you needed to do. Maybe if they didn't, I'm curious about one aspect here of the relationship between Andrew Mellon and the woman that you talked about who died of tuberculosis. This part of the story where, as she's dying and taking a long time to die, she asks him to sing to her. And is that something that you invented?
That is something that I completely invented. The Judge Mellon, who is the founder of the Mellon Bank Empire and Andrew Mellon's father, was a very harsh character. Everything in the book about the way he went about finding a wife, the courtship of the wife, the very strict way he treated his sons, the ongoing autobiography he wrote, which included passages such as "girl children who die young should not be greatly lamented," are all actual parts of his personality. It was the most extreme and strict kind of life that children could have been subjected to, not with the kind of physical deprivation that very poor families in the same circumstances would be subjected to, but certainly in terms of a very severe, severe, severe thinking about the world. The boys were all educated at home because he thought that children in regular schools were coarse, and women were distractions. And assuming, as I assumed reading what little there was about Andrew's absolute devotion to this young woman, even after he knew that she was dying, I found myself imagining that that there must have been parts of him that were touched that he never even knew existed in himself. And it just came to me, I guess, in the way some things just come to writers or artists at times, that this would have been suggestive of some kind of softening and some kind of connection to something in himself, and also a willingness to do anything for her, and that seems to have been the kind of love he felt for her. As I said, it took him so many years to even attempt to get beyond the death of this young woman. And then when he did marry, it was a very foolhardy marriage that went very badly. And so I invented that. I thought, and I actually wanted to imagine what it would be like for someone like him to go into himself and find that capacity, because someone who loved him asked him to do it. Hmm.
You, in the book, talk a little bit about what this place, the club, was like, and about the fact that some wealthy people built some rather grand houses there that charmingly enough, they refer to as cottages.
Yes.
And I think there are some other famous summer places where wealthy people built huge houses and called them cottages. Do those houses still stand? Are they still there?
Some of the houses still stand. Unfortunately, the National Registry of Historic Places didn't move as quickly as they might have to preserve them in the way they might have been preserved. I think that may have had to do with a number of things. The minute the flood occurred, everyone who was a member of that club wanted to disavow any association with it. And so records were destroyed. The club was literally, the club surrounded the lake, and so the clubhouse and the cottages, when the dam broke and flooded the, and I should say something more about that flood since it was so much more than a flood, but and when the lake emptied, the houses were all intact, and it was literally abandoned with tables, china in the china cabinets, and everything just left there because the members of the club feared reprisal and feared what would happen. And it's also the case that they thought that there was no record kept once the membership of the roster of the members was destroyed, that there it would be very difficult to prove who had belonged to the club. And also the club was established as a separate entity so that each of the men individually could not be sued, and they certainly had the vast fortunes that would have been in jeopardy had there been suits. Years later, I mean, so everyone thought, all right, no one knows anything about this. And interestingly enough, in what the biographies that exist of Mellon, Carnegie, Frick, there is no mention of membership in the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. But there was a young man who, unbeknownst, or I mean, people must have known, but most of the photographs he took were of young people. There was a young man, a member of the club, who was kind of interested in tinkering and inventing and knowing the newest technology when he was in his teens. And he kept, he took many, many photographs of life at the club. And a coffee tin was found somewhere in New England, I believe in the early 1960s, by a woman who had bought a house and it was in her attic. And she saw these to be old photographic negatives, and the can was marked South Fork. And she sent them either to the Library of Congress or the Smithsonian, and suddenly these photographs appeared that are very beautiful and are in the Charles Guggenheim documentary about the Johnstown flood, of life at the lake, girls and boys in sailboats, and people dressed in costume to be photographed for tableau vivant. And they're really haunting and quite extraordinary. So suddenly, the secrecy, all that was unknown about life at the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club became known through these photographs, which I thought was quite remarkable and wonderful. And so the Guggenheim documentary gave me a very good sense of what it actually looked like, the girls in their wonderful white dresses and hats and parasols, and boys in their little sailing outfits. And it really helped me visualize all that was going on at that particular time.
We've come to the end of our time, and I hope that we've given people some sense of the book and yet left enough so that people will want to read it. In Sunlight in a Beautiful Garden is the title, by Kathleen Camber, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And our guest, this is her second novel, her first, The Book of Mercy. She, from 1997 until the end of 2000, directed the creative writing program at the University of Houston. Ms. Camber, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.